Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 27th of March 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. I think we just get on with the news today because, as we often say, it's incredible what is taking place in this country.
Recently we had the release of from WikiLeaks of the Vault 7, which was the hacking capabilities of the CIA, included malware, viruses, Trojans, weaponized zero-day exploits, and so on. This is what they're saying. Malware, remote control systems, documentation that went alongside that. And what was interesting about this release was the actually very low-key reaction from the public. No one was terribly surprised. But what was perhaps surprising about it was that it certainly gave evidence that that so-called end-to-end encryption services, such as WhatsApp, continue to remain unhackable by the security services. And as a result, the Vault 7 releases show that the security services have been needing to hack endpoints, and that's phones, tablets, and laptops, so they can't just capture network traffic over the internet, decrypt it, and use it. So it should come as no surprise then that the government is hoping to use momentum from the so-called Westminster terrorist attack to convince people that government should have a back door available to those encrypted services. And of course, Amber Rudd was on the Andrew Marr show on BBC yesterday. She said it's completely unacceptable. There should be no place for terrorists to hide. We need to make sure that organizations like WhatsApp, and there are plenty of others like that, don't provide a secret place for terrorists to communicate with each other. It used to be that people would steam open envelopes or just listen in on phones when they wanted to find out what people were doing legally through warrant. But in this situation, we need to make sure that our intelligence services have the ability to get into situations like encrypted WhatsApp. So this came out because apparently the alleged terrorist had sent a WhatsApp message just previous to just prior to taking the action that he did. It looks like the government intends to use this Westminster event to press forward with justification for their blanket surveillance regime. So what are they going to do? They've clearly decided that they can't make encryption services illegal. And so the only option they have is to argue for a backdoor into the systems. Of course, it wasn't that long ago that the TSA in the United States, they had a master key for all the locks on their any locks, any padlocks they had on any of their storage. And unfortunately, the design of that lock leaked onto the internet, as these things tend to do. And before they knew it, people were printing off with 3D printers the keys, master keys for these locks. So, you know, this is doesn't end with government having the keys to WhatsApp, because the risk is that it actually leaves back doors open for others to access people's information. So we should be absolutely refusing to allow the government to proceed with this.
But there's no substance to this. We've got a so-called terrorist. We don't know a lot about him. Well, we did know a lot about him because he was on MI5's books, but they didn't really know much about him because he wasn't a threat. Now we've got an event, and what's immediately come off the back of this event is that we've got a spy on every aspect of society.
Yeah.
Nobody's asking the key questions: who is going to be doing the spying, and what sort of people are in control of those spies? Are they the people that we should be concerned about? Amber Rudd, does she know what she's doing? I think she's a bit of fluffy nothing. She's simply there to carry out the policy. She thinks she's being very clever, but she's building a prison camp that she's also going to be tied up in.
Absolutely. And so here we go. This is a photograph, obviously, from Ruptly. Apparently, they have built these bollards and what are these things? Are they there eventually to put turnstiles on? But this is on the way into Westminster City. There's no possibility of getting in with a car, it seems, because they're building these things to prevent any kind of similar events happening again.
So these have just popped up over the last couple of days?
They started building these the day following the incident.
So that's some pretty good design and development work, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Or were these already on the books because they knew what the event was going to be?
That's more likely, in my opinion, because where did they magic these things up from?
Yeah.
And what was interesting is on Friday, the traffic cameras were all switched off, so there were no live feeds in the area, so nobody could see this stuff being installed. Wow. We just see the results of it. And I'd just say, because, you know, various people saying that the bollards, the barricades that have popped up, that they're not very, this is a quote from somebody from Rupley, Derek, a Londoner, they're not oppressive and they're here for our security. It doesn't stop people going about their normal daily business, but it does help stop any terrorist attacks such as the ones in Berlin or Westminster the other night. Well, I would say to Derek, I grew up with this, which was the entrance to Royal Avenue in Belfast. All the main entrances to the streets in the centre of the city in the 1970s and early 80s had turnstiles where you had to be searched. You had to queue up to be searched. You had to be searched going into every single shop. Of course, it was for the same reason, because it was to prevent, allegedly, the IRA leaving car bombs in the centre of the city. This was far from being not oppressive at the time.
Yeah. So we've got the same system, but because we've painted it yellow and given the image of something in a children's play area.
And we haven't installed the turnstiles just yet, but clearly capable. There are mountings on there that are clearly capable of holding them. So, you know, this is only the thin end of a wedge.
And no debate in Westminster that I'm aware of as to these extra security. We suddenly just had an announcement within a few hours of the terrorist attack, so-called terrorist attack, that we were going to increase security in London and there may have to be some form of barrier restrictions. And then we have a weekend passes and it's already installed.
Yes.
Remarkable. It's remarkable we can be so efficient at installing barriers and so inefficient at building nuclear power plants.
Indeed. Yes. OK, here we go. Just a quick mention of this. Independent are claiming this as a scoop. But basically, they're saying that when they were attempting to get from Turkey, the Istanbul airport to the UK, one of the airports where you're not supposed to be allowed to take in-flight laptops, basically, they found themselves in an area on the airside where they were able to freely mix with people getting off other aircraft. And, I mean, they're quite rightly saying that this makes a complete mockery of the whole thing. Well, the whole thing's a nonsense in the first place, but there
you go.
Well,
you can also see this with different airports, Mike, because pick an airport, San Francisco, no problem with your laptop. It's stayed in your bag, not really interested in it, not asked about it, not just for myself. This was other passengers going through. And then you try and take a laptop on a plane up to Scotland and then this becomes a big issue. Mm. Some airports you need to take your belt off, your shoes off, others you don't. So there's no common sense, rhyme or reason to it.
It's only for show, if that. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, let's move into this little area, because if we want to know what the changes are in society, the government is now starting to tell us very clearly. This was released in the last couple of days from the House of Lords, stronger charities for a stronger society. I wonder what the comment of child abuse survivors would be to that statement in its raw form. Because, of course, many of those people say, well, they laugh if you mention the main charities, NSPCC or Barnardo's. But here we are from the Lord, stronger charities for stronger society. And it, excuse me, it says we're living through a time of profound economic, social and technological change. And the environment in which charities are working is altering dramatically. We do not believe this is a temporary aberration. Here's the language. Such disruptive changes are likely to become the norm. Well, that's very interesting. How do they know that, Mike? And this is unlikely to be a temporary aberration. Such disruptive changes are likely to become the norm.
They can only know that because that's the intention.
That is the intention. And of course, it's been solely the UK column that has pointed out people talking about the need to have active disruptors in society. And we featured some time ago the TED video with a man from a North London council, might have been South London council, we'll call it up again.
It was Barnet.
Barnet, thank you very much. So a gentleman from Barnet Council on stage being filmed talking about future government and the fact that we needed more disruptors in order to get the necessary change through. So here we've got the policy. The policy is of disruption in order to get the government's change agenda through. What's the change agenda? Well, luckily, this Baroness is going to tell us. So here we are, Baroness Keithley. These are some of her comments in respect to the report. Charities are the eyes, ears and conscience of society. We need stronger charities for a stronger society. Wouldn't it be the case if you had a strong society, you wouldn't need charities because you wouldn't have people who were poor or suffering or...
That's absolutely true. Charities are the eyes and ears of society, yeah. Brian.
Did that remind you of anything?
Well, are charities becoming replacing GCHQ? Is that what's going
well,
on?
Well, I think that's part of it. But eyes, ears certainly made my ears prick up because I remembered this. This is Leeds Advisory Group for Common Purpose. This is the meeting going back to 25th of July 2006. And just for an indication, here is a charity. Common Purpose. We often say this is an oxymoron because, of course, they're a political charity. Here are the sorts of people Common Purpose were bringing together. So we've got a regional director of Common Purpose. We've got a divisional chief superintendent from West Yorkshire Police. We've got newspapers. We've got the university. We've got the council. We've got businesses. We've got people from education sector. All meeting behind closed doors under Chatham House rules of secrecy.
So the two that really stick out are the policeman and the newspaper man, because those two organisations should be kept separate from any of this nonsense.
Indeed. So separation powers gone out of the window under the control of a political charity. Why were we so interested in this particular meeting? Well, it was this statement. Introduction of new advisory group members. The group and new advisory group members were welcomed and introductions were made. Claire went through the advisory briefing pack and reiterated that they're not a board, but the eyes and ears of Common Purpose Leeds, and will feed key business information to the director. They're there to assist with recruitment by spreading the word, putting their own staff on programmes, and making decisions on accepting participants in Matrix. The advisory group should also act as a support in localising the content of the curriculum for Matrix. So think of those orders being given to the very senior policeman there, that his job is not to be a policeman, it's to work for business information for Common Purpose. And what do we see here? We see an excellent look into very, very dangerous activity by the charity Common Purpose. But of course, this is mirrored across many other charities, as we see. Here's the lady, Claire Bennett. You can find her on the Common Purpose website. And according to the information, she's very experienced, design and delivery of leadership development in the West and North Yorkshire area, design and delivery of courses for emerging leaders, youth courses, on it goes. So I don't know where she got all this experience. She's been working for Common Purpose for years, but this is the lady who was simply pointing at policemen, senior policemen, and saying, this is what you will do in order to support Common Purpose. So let's come back to the Baroness and see what else she had to say. She says, charities are the lifeblood of society. They play a fundamental role in our civil life and do so despite facing a multitude of challenges. Yet for them to continue to flourish, it's clear that they must be supported and promoted. So what's coming here? Well, it's pretty simple, because if you're a charity, you're not going to be allowed to act as a charity unless the government is supporting and monitoring you. She says, we found that charities lead the way with innovation, but this is at risk of being stifled by the contract culture. And while advocacy is a sign of healthy democracy and is a central part of charities' role, this role has been threatened by government. Now, this is itself an interesting statement. What she's getting at is the fact that many big charities, Barnardo's, NSPCC, for example, are now doing the work of government. So they are running contracts. They're no longer effectively charities in the sense that most of us would remember. So big contracts, she says, are causing charities problems. So run on through. We hope that charities will be encouraged by this report, that the government will respect their role, and that in addition, it will value the connections charities have with all sections of society and encourage the vital scrutiny they provide. So what we're interested in here, Mike, is the fact that the charity sector, that's about 167,000 charities in UK, representing well over £44 billion. Those charities affect everyone. They affect local communities, very small communities. The government now getting the control in through those charities.
Right. So what Baroness Pitkethley is expressing here echoes what Priti Patel was talking about last week, where they're going to fund particularly smaller charities. They're going to give them grants. But in order to achieve that grant funding, they have to agree to special training.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, that is
the control.
The control.
OK, so let's have a look at Mike's hit that absolutely on the button. So let's just put a few things together. This report was itself reported by Third Sector magazine. Very good article. Encourage people to go and have a look at it. And it says that basically charities are going to be encouraged to report to government on how they perform, and they're going to be encouraged, as Mike says, to do training for the government. So why should we be interested in all this? Well, in that article, this is one of the organisations mentioned, the New Philanthropy Capital, and they say, we've seen our approach adopted and adapted as far afield as Brazil, Germany, Sweden and Israel. So we now get a clue that this is not UK internal policy. There's something much deeper here. And why would we be interested with New Philanthropy Capital? Well, if we look at who created it, it's Goldman Sachs, the very same bank that's busy helping the British Army to train at the moment alongside Barclays. So back to the where are we? Back to this one again. Let's have a look at another aspect of this article, because we've got power to change mentioned. And we've got a gentleman called Christopher Stevens. He was chairman of the Judicial Appointments Commission. So we've got a nice mix here, Mike. 1 minute we're talking about charities. We then have a look at the interest of the senior people involved, and they're busy appointing judges. And at the same time, they're part of the salaries board, the salaries review board for the top civil service commissioners who are going to give them the money through the government in the first place. But there's no conflict of interest, luckily.
None at all.
None at all. So what else can we add to this one? Well, in the article, it also mentions Lloyd Bank Foundation. So we've got another bank coming in here just to make sure that we know who's controlling who. So pretty obvious that the banks are well into this scheme. This is power to change. What do they say? No one understands a community better than the people who live there. We work with community businesses to revive local assets, protect the services people rely on, and address local needs.
Is that assets in the sense of intelligence gathering?
I think that's exactly what's going on. They are trying to get people to believe they're coming along to help the local children's football team that needs some help refurbishing their ground. But if you have a look at what's going on here, massive data collection. And we shouldn't be surprised, because, of course, it was this gentleman, Eric Pickles, who said that we are going to shake up the balance of power in this country. We're going to change the nature of the Constitution. Now, he said that alone, no debate. He said he was going to be a revolutionary and the revolution was going to start here. So what we are really seeing coming in now is this central core of big society. This diagram was we did years ago, but it showed the change agents driving through the third sector to produce this common purpose based big society. And this is going to be, well, you talked about this the other day, Mike. This is Theresa May. She's calling it the shared society.
Yeah.
But it's exactly the same thing. We're just using slightly different language.
So, again, this is a constitutional change. Localism. OK, the localism bill has gone through. It became the Localism Act. But that's quite constrained and limited. Whereas most of this change seems to be pretty much unlimited. And no real debate in Parliament about what this change is, where it's taking us. Certainly no debate in Parliament about Eric Pickles suggesting that he's a revolutionary. And so there are quite a number of areas of policy where there seems to be stuff happening that has not arisen
ever been
from
debated.
A debate in Parliament.
Yeah, and this, of course, is because there is effectively no Westminster. We simply have the Cabinet Office with its special advisers driving policy. We're going to have a look at a bit of that in a minute. And backbenchers are simply, well, they're simply puppets sitting on the side.
Well, at the end of last week, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, was speaking to the general staff of the military academy, the military academy of the general staff, I should say. And he was talking about Afghanistan, and he was describing it as an example of the United States' long-standing policy of what he was calling managed chaos. And he absolutely singled out drug trafficking as an example of this. He said the US operation against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda was supported by all countries. It's another matter that after receiving the international approval, the United States and its NATO allies, which took over in Afghanistan, started acting rather inconsistently, to put it mildly. During their operation in Afghanistan, the terrorist threat has not been rooted out, while the drug threat has increased many times over. The drug industry prospered. There is factual evidence that some of the NATO contingents in Afghanistan turned a blind eye to the illegal drug trafficking, even if they were not directly involved in these criminal schemes. Afghanistan is a separate case, although the current developments there, which are a result of the NATO operation's failure, despite the carte blanche the bloc received from the international community, can be considered an unintended cause of managed chaos. In Iraq, Syria and Libya, this chaos was created intentionally. Well, I have to say, Lavrov being typically diplomatic, perhaps, let's just remember the situation, because while Afghanistan was in the hands of the Taliban, opium production dropped to almost nothing, and the acreage had dropped to almost nothing. Once NATO troops moved in, opium production skyrocketed far in excess of the levels of the year 2000. Was that a coincidence? Well, Lavrov doesn't think so, although he's being rather gentle by suggesting that it was merely people turning a blind eye. NATO claimed that images of Western troops sort of running around in the poppy fields would force farmers into the hands of insurgents. So that's why they wouldn't do it. That was what they said anyway. But of course, as we said, the Taliban regime, which ran Afghanistan in 2001, just before we moved in to root them out, had pretty much stopped the opium production. But let's just remind ourselves of what this gentleman said, John Walters. This was a memo from the US Office for Drug Control Policy. And he had met with General Mitchell, the commander of International Security Assistance Force. That was the sort of he was the overall commander of the NATO operation, I guess, at the time. And McNeil told Walters there had been a lot of action on counter narcotics, but little progress. He was particularly dismayed by the British effort. They had made a mess of things, he said in this memo in Helmand. Their tactics were wrong. The deal that London cut on Musa Kala had failed. We'll come on to that in a second. And that the Musa Kala agreement opened the door for narco traffickers in that area, and now it was impossible to tell the difference between the traffickers and the insurgents. Now, the Musa Qala deal that was mentioned in the memo was an agreement with the Taliban that our troops would pull out of key drug trafficking areas, for example, Musa Qala in Helmand, and in return, the Taliban agreed not to attack ISAF forces in the region. But the result of that was that the drug traffickers had free rein to do what they wished, and insurgents eventually regained full control of the area. Also, let's not forget this Afghani MP, Nazime Niazi, saying as long as foreign forces are present in Afghanistan, the cultivation, production and trafficking of drugs will continue in the country. And even towards the end of last year, we reported this latest report from the UNODC, poppy production up 10% since 2015. Eradication, which is the key thing, was down 91%. There's really no excuse for that unless what you want is to see more opium on the black market. There's no other explanation for it, really. So eradication down 91% since 2015, yield up 30% since 2015. And as France 24 reporting here, the fact that Afghanistan now producing multiple harvests every year. And let's remember this quote from an Afghani opium farmer. I can't remember where I got this from now, but basically saying opium is money. Why should we waste time growing wheat? And we should also just remember the irony that, of course, British farmers are growing opium in this country at the moment because the NHS cannot find enough opiates for painkillers on the markets. So we have to grow opium in this country despite the bumper harvests from Afghanistan. So I think Lavrov being too soft, focusing on the United States, possibly not the main perpetrator here, perhaps Britain is the main perpetrator, perhaps the City of London financial centres and institutions that are benefiting from the drugs money are the main perpetrators here.
Certainly.
Yes.
And isn't it remarkable that at the moment it's UK column, it's other so-called alternative media outlets which are talking about the reality of this. None of these statistics appearing on the BBC or any of the British mainstream newspapers. Why would that be? Ignorance, inability to research? There's some questions to be answered, I think.
Yeah. OK, and then let's move on to Yemen. Well, there was actually a protest over the weekend in London on the situation in Yemen. Unfortunately, it didn't seem to be hugely big. So 2 years since the beginning of the Yemen conflict, Saudi Arabian jets bombing Lebanon Yemen in you know, to death, really. And so on Sunday, what RT here describes is dozens of protesters meeting at Marble Arch near Hyde Park to show solidarity. I would say that if anybody's organising an event like this, we'd be very keen to hear about it and give it any publicity we can. So please let us know. So what was interesting was that the demonstrators decided that they would march towards the BBC offices with End Yemen Siege and Hands Off Yemen on their placards and so on. I didn't see the BBC reporting this particular protest. So there you go. It's up to RT to report it. Despite the fact they ended up outside. But a better turnout in Yemen itself. Millions of Yemenis, certainly hundreds of thousands, if not a million, protesting 2 years of Saudi murder, according to this tweet. This was in Sana'a. So well done to them. At least they're getting out. I would say we need to get a lot more people doing something about the situation in Yemen, because this war, underreported, absolute disgrace, particularly because we're helping by providing Saudi Arabia with the weaponry that they need.
Well, of course, Mr. Fallon has said that the objective of Britain's defence policy is not only to help defend the world, but it's to sell those arms and munitions.
Yes, indeed. But of course, we're doing better than that, because what's happening, Oxfam here reiterating the fact that what we're looking at in Yemen is famine, extreme famine. Lots of people, millions of people, 7 million people on the brink of famine, according to Oxfam. And of course, that gives Britain the excuse that they need to send in the British controlled NGOs with international development money to bring about change in Yemen. So we we get to follow our foreign policy objectives by bombing the country into the Stone Age and bringing people to the brink of starvation. In the meantime, of course, Saudi Arabia not wanting to improve the situation. This photograph sent to me yesterday with the result of Saudi Arabia bombing Sana'a Airport, one of the main areas where food is coming into the country, because of course Yemen has always imported its food supply. So the airports and the ports either being blockaded or bombed to bits, preventing food getting into the country. And I'll just end with this, which I thought was really spectacular hypocrisy from Sky News. Civilian casualties are abhorrent to be expected. He's talking about Mosul in this case. But of course, it's absolutely unacceptable whenever we are liberating or whenever a city is being liberated. In the case of Aleppo, of course, it's unacceptable for any civilian casualties at all in that situation. But when it's Mosul and it's us bombing, then it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah.
So unbelievable hypocrisy here.
Weren't we supposed to have had Mosul sorted out by now? Wasn't it all supposed to be all part of a peaceful state and much better because we've got in there and bombed most of the infrastructure to pieces? But now it was going to be okay in 2016-17?
Absolutely.
Perpetual war. Whose advantage of that? Well, the West and the City of London.
Yeah.
So where can we go from that? Well, who is controlling Britain? We don't think it is anything to do with elected politicians. What we see on a daily basis is increasing control over Britain's politicians, whether it's the Prime Minister, members of the Cabinet or other backbenchers. And as we consistently say, the child abuse is the engine of politics in Britain. But who else is operating behind the scenes? Well, we picked up on this Mail article here, which is talking about the internet giant Uber. And this story is all about the provision of taxis in London. So the Mail says Cameron Osborne, their glamorous chum and the great Uber stitch up the disturbing links between Number 10 and the online taxi firm, as it's revealed. One of its major investors now has the ex-chancellor on its payroll. Well, this was an interesting article, but I believe that the Mail simply didn't get to grips with the right part of the story.
Just before you go on to the main part of this, is that another job that George Osborne's got then?
Well, he's somewhere in the major investment part of that, right. Mike. I didn't focus on that because, to me, that wasn't really the important part of the article. And one of the key things about this story is that it's talking about traditional taxi drivers in London being wiped out because this American company can come in and call up taxis much faster, much cheaper than they can do the job, even though statistics say that the number of Uber's drivers who've been involved in some form of sexual offence with passengers is really quite high. So what sort of things were said? Well, said within days, the paper saying, I can reveal the deputy head of Cameron's policy unit, Daniel Korski, had been assigned to lead secret crisis talks between the mayor and his senior staff and a range of ministers and Downing Street figures. Korski orchestrated a series of meetings about Uber during October, November and December last year, according to emails and other documents released under the Freedom of Information Act and obtained by the Mail. So basically, David Cameron, George Osborne pushing for support for Uber. And when people started to ask what had been going on and why, they started to block the Freedom of Information requests. And then Ms. Korski was used as some form of heavyweight. Well, he's the man that I was interested in because who is he? Well, luckily, there are some pictures. So we've got one here with his Mr. Korski and his partner, Fiona Elwyn, if I pronounce that correctly. He's described as the Prime Minister's shadowy hitman. But in this article, he's gone for the career of John Langworth, who was the chairman of the British Chamber of Commerce. He was apparently a little bit too anti-EU. So in came Daniel Korsky as the heavyweight to tell him what to do. Well, who is this young man? Well, this is where it gets really interesting. Use Wikipedia to get a bit of basic information, but you discover that he's been working for Andrew Mitchell MP. He's also been working with Catherine Ashton, very interesting person. He's apparently Polish, came to UK with his parents, Jewish family, but they spent time living in Denmark, and he's been very active with the European Union. So who is this man and what is his real allegiance? You've no way of knowing. But it gets even better, because if we bring in a bit of the LinkedIn information, you find that he's had amazing jobs in the EU, special advisor as part of Condoleezza Rice's team. Then he moves back into the cabinet. He's in with the European Commission. What is this man?
Very, very special.
Very, very special.
Internationalist.
Yeah. And he's used by David Cameron to warn off people who dare to challenge the internal political views. So I think the real story is about this sort of man, this caliber of individual, and how these people have been brought into the British system of government, totally unelected, of course, but they're now helping to drive some pretty vicious policy. Well, we get a bit more of this story from The Sun, taken for a ride. Cameron cronies covered up attempts to lobby for Uber before Bojo's failed crackdown on the cab firm. This is because Boris Johnson did actually try and at least halt their advances to some extent in order to protect London cab drivers. But in this article, we get more of the story because this lady appears, Rachel Whetstone. She's now Uber senior vice president. But of course, she was former head of communications for Google when Cameron was clearly in bed with Google. And I think relations over David Cameron's boy at one stage with Rachel. So it says that it's emerged number 10 failed to give details under the Freedom of Information laws last year. Calls are now being made for an inquiry over the alleged cover-up and the government's link to the US taxi firm. Well, of course, it is a cover-up because we already know that Freedom of Information rules were not followed. Mm. So who are these people?
Just a few of Britain's unelected shadow government.
Very dark. Public has no idea who these people are. They have no idea what their job titles are, what their real responsibilities. Who are they accountable to? Anybody? We've no idea.
No. Well, new week, new NATO exercise, this time in Scotland. This is one of Europe's largest exercises, joint warrior. It's held twice a year, in the spring and in the autumn. So it runs from now until the 6th of April. Apparently involves warships operating from Faslane and the Clyde and aircraft from Lossiemouth and Moray. They're going to have some live firing training, so that's good. 35 naval units and more than 50 aircraft are going to be used. So this is the biggest exercise in Europe, 50 aircraft and 35 boats. So it's huge, Brian. Countries taking part: Denmark, Belgium, Estonia, France, Germany, Netherlands, Norway, Spain, Sweden, UK and the United States. Thousands of personnel, 16 Air Assault Brigade headquarters and its associated battle group are going to be taking part in the land-based training. Second Para are going to be joined by troops from the Netherlands, Sweden and the US. So that's all good, but it gets better, because running in parallel is Exercise Information Warrior, and this is going to be run by the Royal Navy. It's the Royal Navy's large-scale cyber war games. There you go. Did you take part in cyber war games, Brian?
No, we
did they have computers in this?
Yeah, they did. We did have computers. I'm only smiling in that most of the communication problems were due to communicating throughout NATO, where we used to see some really amazing delays in signal traffic. Some signals arriving a few days late, but it's not really a problem.
Well, the hint perhaps comes from the logo there, because Information Warrior 17 is going to involve testing artificial intelligence and the protection of warships and submarines during cyber attacks. But I think they're going to be running their little speedboats that have that are apparently autonomous.
Yeah. I'm fascinated, Mike, to know what this is, because a cyber attack on what? On your communication system? Well, that's a pretty normal part of military policy, been going on for years. You have to maintain secure communications. Or are they suggesting that somebody's going to get into the computer systems on board the warships? And if that's the case, then this ought to have been addressed several years ago. So I think this is largely a publicity stunt in order to get cyber matters raised.
Well, that I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, cyber right at the heart of all of NATO's public relations efforts at the moment. It's being used as the sort of driving force for quite a lot of the internal change within NATO. And it's certainly being used as the driving force for NATO-EU military cooperation.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to end on this one. Now, we don't normally like petitions as such, but I think this one is absolutely worthwhile, and we need to support it if we can. This is from an organisation called Survivors of Child Sexual Abuse, and they're saying, we demand government, Labour and Lib Dems investigate allegations that MPs raped children. They say, we call on the government, the Labour Party and the Lib Dems to launch investigations into investigations that MPs and peers raped children or conspired to help others to do so during the administrations of John Major and Margaret Thatcher. Conservative, Labour and Lib Dem MPs and peers are widely named by child abuse survivors and contemporary witnesses whose personal testimonies are mutually corroborate. Moreover, many of the MPs and peers whom child abuse survivors and witnesses identify are still alive. Some continue to sit in Parliament. The crimes in which they are implicated, covered up and buried. The ongoing independent inquiry into child sexual abuse and police investigations are essential and long overdue. Notwithstanding the CSA and police inquiries, the government, Labour Party and Lib Dems must launch their own investigations. These should seek out and analyse internal party files, historical complaints by party activists, whistleblowers and employees, and the private records and memories of MPs and peers, deceased, retired and still serving. Absent proactive and exhaustive investigations by government and the main parties in Westminster, the Child Sexual Abuse Inquiry and crime agencies may be unable to discover and consult these crucial sources for evidence of crimes long buried. Do go and look at this page. It's on change.org. It goes into a lot of background and rationale. They highlight some hotspots, Islington being a key one, Islington Children's Homes in the 1980s under the oversight of Margaret Hodge, assisted by Keith Vaz. They talk about Richmond upon Thames Children's Homes of the same period. They talk about Westminster City Council, real estate in the same period, Lambeth Borough Council, Wales, Clwyd and Gwynedd Children's Homes, Kincora in Belfast, Channel Islands, of course, Oudtdullaghgaran, and then they name some names. The 1990s reports, they're talking about media reports, do name and implicate several prominent Conservative parliamentarians, including Peter Bottomley, Edward Lee, Julian Lewis. Now, of course, they are not naming these names. These are names that have arisen from mainstream media reports from the 1990s, which have basically been brushed under the carpet. And so there's a whole list of names. I do suggest you go and have a look at that and support that petition.
Incredible, isn't it, that people have obviously taken a lot of trouble there, Mike, to list out events that have been reported publicly, aside from witness testimony over the years. The government keeps telling us there is no child abuse in Westminster. This suggests otherwise. And I'd also like to say that our very brave Metropolitan Police whistleblower, John Wedger, I'm able to use his full name now. This was the man that did the wonderful interview with us a few months ago, talking about what he had seen relating to child abuse in London, the cover-up by senior police officers, by local authorities, by child protection charities, and of course by politicians. He is under tremendous pressure again. He's been put on half pay. He's basically being harassed most of the time by the Metropolitan Police. Absolutely no action taken by the policing minister. No response from any of the other politicians. This is what happens when a policeman stands up and actually tells the truth about what's been going on. So John Wedger, keep him in your thoughts and prayers, because he needs our support. I'm delighted to say, though, that there is still a teaming up of other policemen and women who've got similar information, and they say they are not going to simply disappear into the background over this. But we need to help and support these people. And I'll also say, to end our programme today, please, excuse me, can you help us promote the British Constitution Group event in Nottingham on the 22nd of April? This is a phenomenal opportunity to bring together people who are already out doing things to expose what's going on in UK. What do we want to do? We want to bring people together to share knowledge, tactics, experience, and of course, just to have the fun and satisfaction of bringing good people together. So if you cannot come, that's very unfortunate, and we are disappointed at that, of course. But can you please help promote this? Because we know there are many other people out there who still have not heard that this event is on, and we need as much help as possible to text it, email it, letters, telephone, speak, whatever you can do, help us promote this event to make it the success that it needs to be. Thanks very much. That ends the news today. We'll be back at same time tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.